emigration, and the quite recent reports from Kinshasa, that's of course the capital of Zaire, testify to the numerical expansion of cases presently registered. Curiously, the historical articulation occurs in Africa, as in the Caribbean, around 1975. But what has happened in Africa? A question for geopoliticians here again. Okay, so again, what they're talking about is that the epidemic phase of this disease, in other words, the movement of this disease from merely being whatever it was before to the extent that it was so low level that it was, when identified, was probably in most cases identified as something else or thought of as being a rare disease or a rare variant, since death from AIDS is often caused by another disease, almost entirely. It's always caused by another disease, since the immune system has been rendered ineffective. There are probably many cases in the past of, if there was such a disease before 1975, many cases that were undiagnosed because the death was attributed to whatever the actual causative factor was. But again, as the author, Leibowitz, is making the point here, that the articulation, the change occurs in Africa and in the Caribbean around 1975. Again, bear in mind, as we read earlier in the broadcast, that in 1969, the Department of Defense Chemical and Biological Warfare people were giving a timetable of 5 to 10 years. Within 6 years, around 1975, as the author puts it, the articulation of the disease occurred in Africa, specifically in Zaire in this case. So we see, again, about a six-year time frame for the real change. From whatever the factor may, whether it's a combinant factor, whether it's a series of diseases that are only in conjunction are effective, whether it is a single virus, as the National Cancer Institute suggests, that knocks out the T cells, whether it's a disease that mutates once it gets into the system, whatever the case may be, around 1975 in Africa and the Caribbean, which for our purposes are the root points of this disease, the disease went from being a minor problem or a non-existent problem to moving toward epidemic proportions.
All right, now we're going to take a look at the incidence of AIDS in third world countries, specifically in the Caribbean and in Africa. Reading now from the Annals of Internal Medicine, specifically volume 103, number 5, from the Annals of Internal Medicine, November of 1985. Going to read some sections from an article, The International Occurrence of the Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, by J.B. Brunet, or Brunet, B-R-U-N-E-T, and R.A. Ancel, A-N-C-E-L-L-E. And reading the introduction to this article, again, from the Annals of Internal Medicine, November 1985. Through December 1984, 9,932 cases of the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome were reported, mainly from North and South America and Europe. 85% of these cases occurred in the United States. Haiti in the United States had the highest incidence rates, 59 and 36 per million population respectively. Rates in the United States range from 0.3 beginning of 1981 to 10.4 end of 1984. Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Switzerland, France, West Germany, the United Kingdom, and the Netherlands show a slower increase. Homosexual men and intravenous drug users are still the main risk groups in the United States and Europe. The disease is prevalent in heterosexual Haitians and Africans, whether they live in their own countries or abroad. Cases of the syndrome have been identified in Zaire, Rwanda, Zambia, and Uganda, but its full extent is not yet known. Consistent with the general history of epidemics, the appearance of geographically separated sites of incidence of the syndrome could be linked to population migrations. However, no evidence has been found to identify an index location. That's by way of general introduction. Now, getting down to the actual incidence of AIDS here, it's worth noting the three highest incidence of AIDS three nations with the highest incidence of AIDS in the world. Again, from the Annals of Internal Medicine, November 85. Rates per million inhabitants show disparities between countries. Haiti and the United States have the highest rates, 59 and 36 cases per million respectively, followed by Grenada, 20 cases per million. Of course, Grenada only has 100,000 residents, so that is only a total of 2 cases, but within that limited population group, that figure is as significant as it would be for any larger group. Again, reviewing the figures, the three highest incidents of AIDS in the world. The first is Haiti, of course. Now, Haiti, up until very recently, was under the thumb of the Duvalier regime, an overtly fascistic, American-supported dictatorship, and, of course, a slightly down-home version of fascism with the voodoo and the Tonton Macoute and so forth. The point being that Haiti was, up until very recently, a U.S.-supported dictatorship. Second highest incidence is in the United States, and the third highest is Grenada. Now, of course, in October of 1983, Grenada was invaded by the United States. The legitimate government of Grenada was overthrown and deposed by American arms. And so it's interesting here that Grenada should have the third highest incidence of AIDS in the world. Fourth highest, by the way, is Trinidad, with 13.3 cases per million. But the two of the three countries with the highest incidence of AIDS are U.S.-affiliated totalitarian governments in the Caribbean. The second one, of course, is the United States itself.
Okay, now some other interesting things about Grenada. We're going to read a short, very short segment from an article from the Los Angeles Times for November 6, 1983. The headline was, "Medical School on Grenada Was Secure All Along." The article is by Peter G. Bourne. Now, Peter G. Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E, as many of our listeners know, since his name has come up before, is a very interesting individual. Peter Bourne, well, among other things, wound up being the director of the medical institute on the medical school in Grenada. But before that, he was, among other things, he had worked for Jimmy Carter and was the chief White House medical director until he was given the boot rather unceremoniously for writing an illegal prescription for Quaaludes for one of his subordinates. And before that, and you're going to have to remind me on this, Dave, when Peter Bourne was in the military, he was affiliated with...
the U.S. Army's... he was in charge of neuropsychiatric research for the Army in Vietnam, which translated in One Step Beyond Radio Free America Political Code, translates mind control.
Now... at the beginning of Peter Bourne's article, Peter Bourne also has some other rather interesting connections to the death of, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy through a long and complex route that we won't go into tonight for our purposes. But needless to say, he's cropped up in a couple of places before. He has a very interesting pedigree, so to speak. Part of his interesting pedigree is his father, especially for our consideration of AIDS and medical research into AIDS tonight. And he starts his article on the Grenadan Medical School this way. "In 1977, my father," Bourne writes, "who recently had retired from Atlanta's Emory University after a career as a medical scientist and director of the Yerkes Primate Center, accepted the post of vice chancellor at the new St. George's University Medical School in Grenada." Now, according to other sources, some of which we're not sure how reliable they are, there are definite suggestions that Peter Bourne's father kept connections with the Yerkes Primate Center very strongly after he had retired and accepted the post in Grenada.
It's also worth noting that his position with the Yerkes Primate Center was he was in charge of immunobiology and pathology at the Yerkes Primate Center.
Indeed. Now, the reason this is going to be significant is going to come up in the next article. And again, as so often with this, as Dave mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, this is all speculation, and especially because we're examining so many different facets of this thing, we cannot pretend that every coincidence is in fact evidence of something. It could not be, because again, we're looking at several mutually exclusive propositions, you know, with the substance of AIDS itself, what it actually is, things like that, and the source for it, and even if we establish the source, or even if we postulate the source as being man-made, we still have talked about several different possible origins for it as man-made, and they are mutually exclusive at this point. However, there is an interesting connection to the Yerkes Primate Center coming up.
Now, one of the points that should be emphasized with regard to all of the different features that we're looking at is that maybe the single most important element to remember is all of the different pathways leading back to what from the AIDS investigation to one aspect or another of the U.S. national security establishment. Now, in connection with Grenada, the medical school, and the Yerkes Primate Center, it might be useful to review the role of the medical center in the U.S. invasion of Grenada.
And before we do that, let me just mention quickly, especially since we're talking about basically three of the high outside of the United States. Three of the very highest incidents of AIDS are occurring in Zaire, in Africa, where President Mobutu of Zaire has been the CIA's man all along. In Haiti, where until recently Jean-Claude Duvalier was the American's man all along. and in Grenada, where at the time that some of these events began to transpire and the first connections between Bourne Sr. and the medical center came about and things like that. The man in charge of Grenada was a man by the name of Sir Eric Geary. Sir Eric Geary closely affiliated with the CIA. Many people have suggested that without CIA funding, he would not have in fact become the Prime Minister of Grenada. Eric Geary himself, a very strange character, one who was fully as capable of, how can we put this, one who was fully as capable of disregarding the welfare of his people as anybody in the Duvalier family was capable of. A very strange man.
Also a fellow who has been known to touch bases with Jim Jones. In fact, Eric Geary was Jim Jones' guest at the People's Temple building in San Francisco in the mid-1970s.
Absolutely. Now, at the time, in 1983, when this all went down, the government in charge of Grenada at that time had replaced Eric Geary. Eric Geary had been chased out of Grenada, and the government that had replaced him was known as the New Jewel Movement, and it was headed by one Maurice Bishop. Now, at the time when he first came into government, Maurice Bishop appealed for help from governments all over the world. He got some help from European governments and Canada and others, and much like Nicaragua, no help was forthcoming from the United States. But, among other things, he got help from the Cubans, but one of the main things he got help from the Cubans on was the fact that the agencies, the World Bank and related organizations that lend money to needy countries said that Grenada's only hope was tourism and that they should go out and build a giant airstrip and so that they could accommodate tourist jets. So among other things, the Cubans were working with the aid of British and German contractors to build this airstrip. Now, the airstrip was one of the reasons that was cited by the Reagan administration as the danger of Grenada. This is before the invasion. But during the time of Maurice Bishop's tenure, as he grew closer to Fidel Castro, and he was very popular among his people, the Reagan administration harped constantly on this airstrip, which again was built at the suggestions of international financial organizations in which the United States had the largest say, and was being built with the help of British and German contractors, and only incidentally by Cuban laborers. So then at the time that the Grenadian incursion occurred, the Bishop government had been mysteriously overthrown from out of nowhere, for all absolutely no reason anybody can see, by a group purporting to be extremist left-wing Marxist army generals coming out of nowhere. This, incidentally, about the same time that Frank Turple showed up in Grenada. We've talked, of course, a great deal about Frank Turple on various Radio Free America shows.
Covered his presence in Grenada on Radio Free America number 4, by the way.
So, this mysterious left-wing violent coup crops up out of nowhere, and the first thing that they do is drag off Maurice Bishop, the most popular man in Grenada, and promptly kill him. Now, the United States then says, well, we didn't like Maurice Bishop, but we like these guys even less, and we have a medical school on Grenada, and we have to protect the students. Now, most of the students' families came forward at that time and said, leave it alone. They're fine. The government has promised that they'll be fine. They're under no danger. There's just a curfew there. Well, nonetheless, this was used as our excuse to go in, shoot, you know, the Cubans who are working on the roads, and take over Grenada, et cetera, et cetera. So the medical school was used, the danger to U.S. students at that medical school was used as the primary reason for the takeover of Grenada, which, of course, now that Maurice Bishop had been disposed of, who was the most popular man in Grenada, and the government that had killed him could be set up as the whipping boy and could be quite easily disposed of as well.
It should be noted that Maurice Bishop had specifically, during his tenure as head of state in Grenada, had cited that medical school as basically a center of U.S.-based subversion. He strongly suspected the medical school of having intelligence connections, which is specifically why, since we've seen that Grenada has the third highest incidence per million of AIDS in per million of population of AIDS in the world, we've also taken a look at how the vice chancellor of the Grenadian Medical School, of the St. George's Medical School on Grenada, Dr. Jeffrey Bourne, was also very closely affiliated with the Yerkes Primate Center at Emory University, and the possible significance of the intersection of these three is to be made clear by an article that I'm about to read you. Following article comes from the San Francisco Examiner of December 30th, 1982. Stateline Atlanta, it's a UPI story headlined, "Benign Monkey Virus is a Good Model," unquote, may help war on AIDS. An AIDS-like virus that has had no effect on a colony of research monkeys may be a good model for the development of a vaccine, an Emory University researcher says. It's a relatively recent finding that we believe shows a lot of potential as far as using animals' potential problems in studying the AIDS problem, said Dr. Harold McClure yesterday. McClure, head of Emory's Yerkes Primate Research Center, said the virus was found earlier this year in a colony of about 90 sooty mangabe monkeys. The virus appeared to be widespread in the colony but has not caused illness, he said. Something is allowing the animals to live with the virus without developing clinical illness, said McClure. The virus found in the monkeys is similar in nearly every respect to the HTLV-3 agent that causes acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which has been fatal in half of the human cases. McClure said both viruses affect only certain cells in the immune system, and both produce antibodies that cause closely related reactions in blood tests. McClure and other Yerkes researchers are studying the virus in collaboration with the National Centers for Disease Control. And skipping down in the article, a major problem, he said, is other possible factors that make the AIDS virus lethal. Published reports say 1 million people or more are infected with the AIDS virus, HTLV-3. However, based on the information available to date, only 10% of those are expected to come down with the clinical AIDS. The question is, why does that 10% come down with it, or more important, why does the 90% not come down with AIDS? Well, obviously the cross-vectoring scenario is one that we're going to be looking at, we've looked at and are going to look at again some more here in a minute. It's worth noting here that the Yerkes Primate Center at Emory University is very, very much involved with AIDS research, so that with the intersection in the person of Dr. Jeffrey Bourne between the Yerkes Primate Center and the St. George's Grenada Medical School on Grenada, the fact that Grenada exhibits the third highest incidence of AIDS in the world is possibly significant, and again, we may have another link to the U.S. National Security Establishment through that.
Okay, now we mentioned earlier that a very high rate of incidence of AIDS prevails in Zaire. Now, several interesting things. Now, there apparently, as we mentioned before, in Africa, this is primarily a heterosexual disease, but it is showing up in large quantities, at least the syndrome itself is, and also the presence of the antibodies themselves, which again suggest the disease not necessarily in a dormant stage, but it could be in a rebuffed stage that it had occurred and been beaten off, or a number of things of that sort. But there are phenomenally high levels. Now, reading again from
Annals of Internal Medicine, November 1983, and specifically.
Right.
Digging down and back here in a second.
It's the Brunei and Ansel article, right further on. Now, they're talking specifically in this case. Again, this is a very unscientific sort of a chart that they're being forced to use because, as we'll talk about later, the Africans themselves appear to be rather reluctant to divulge a lot of the information on the occurrence of AIDS in Africa. But this is based on people coming to be treated for acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and the list they have here out of a total of 111 from some maybe 15 or 20 African countries, out of a total of 111 showing up to be treated, 74 were from Zaire, 74 out of a total of 111.
That incidence, by the way, is collaborated in the earlier New Scientist article from October 18th of 84, in which British scientists in Africa corroborated that AIDS appeared to be most highly developed in Zaire.
Now, down at the end of this, right after the chart, it says, tracing the course of an epidemic has many of the same elements found in a detective story. Amen. The difference is that there is no murderer to track except the infectious agent itself. No scientific evidence has yet been given to identify the origin of the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and the history of epidemics suggests that this mystery may never be solved. Well, that's not necessarily the case, and we think if one keeps an open mind, one can at least speculate on the possibility that there is a murderer to track, or that there might be.
The wording reminds me of the sorts of statements that the sorts of equivocations one sees concerning the Kennedy assassination and other political assassinations in this country, where people say, well, we'll never know for sure. Those who have bothered to examine the facts do know for sure, or about as closely as anyone is ever going to know. But again, the fact that Zaire is apparently in Africa the place of greatest AIDS infection is worth noting for our purposes, because Zaire, since the early 1960s, has been quite literally a CIA fiefdom run by a man named Mobutu Sese Seko. And Mobutu Sese Seko is a CIA protege all the way. Confirmation of that comes from a number of different sources. The one we're going to use here is a book called Endless Enemies, subtitled The Making of an Unfriendly World. It's by Wall Street Journal reporter Jonathan Quitney, last name Quitny. Published in hardcover by Congdon and Weed Incorporated of New York, and copyrighted 1984. About Mobutu Sese Seko, Zaire, and the Central Intelligence Agency, Quitney writes as follows. Mobutu, a barefoot army sergeant when he first walked into the CIA office in Kinshasa in the 1950s, has since called himself one of the three richest men in the world, an estimate believed to be in the ballpark. He customarily jails or exiles anyone he thinks might be a threat to him. This is a recent reform of his administration. He used to kill such people. Now, under pressure from Western friends to clean up his act, more and more he gives his political enemies hints of their impending doom a few hours in advance, so that they might take off by canoe across the Congo River to Brazzaville in the neighboring Republic of Congo, and thence by plane to Europe. The point being here that Mobutu, not only a CIA protege, basically a CIA babysitter for Zaire, but the point being that Mobutu is also a ruthless, ruthless individual who has never shown the slightest hesitation at spilling the blood of his countrymen and women, and doing so in apparently copious amounts. So again, if, hypothetically speaking, you're the U.S. National Security Establishment, and you want to find a third world country, say in Africa or the Caribbean, that in which to test viruses and about obviously in so doing kill and maim a lot of people, a place like Haiti with Duvalier or a place like Zaire with Mobutu Sese Seko wouldn't be a bad place to do it.
Or Grenada under Gary.
Right.
Now, again, on the subject of Mobutu Sese Seko, and as an example of some of the people who weren't given a chance to get across the river to Brazzaville in the Republic of Congo, Amnesty International published a little list of some of the incidents that have happened during the reign of Mobutu. This, again, also from Jonathan Quitney's Endless Enemies. In April 1982, Mungul Diaka, the former political aide to Mobutu, issued a compilation of massacres in Zaire, attempting to show that the Mubuji Mai incident was part of a pattern. Among the 14 incidents he cited were the hanging of four cabinet ministers without the right of self-defense in an alleged plot against Mobutu in 1966, the killing of several thousand Katangese soldiers by burning or burying alive or jettisoning from helicopters in 1967, the killing of several hundred peacefully demonstrating students at the National University of Kinshasa in 1969, the massacre of more than 500 innocent people in several villages in May 1970 in reprisal for the killing of a soldier who had tried to steal a chicken, the massacre of 2,000 to 2,500 religious sect members in Kitawala in January 1978, the massacre of 150 people in eastern Kasai on October 6, 1981, after some villagers challenged some army officers who were dealing illegally in ivory, the alleged harassment during 1981 of Cardinal Joseph Albert Malula, Archbishop of Kinshasa, for having criticized the government. Mungul Diaka said the archbishop slept in a different house every night because of the threats against him. Mobutu also held a grudge against the archbishop because when Pope John Paul II visited Zaire in 1980, Mobutu had wanted the pope to marry him to a new wife, and the archbishop had been the one to inform Mobutu that the pope wouldn't do it. Mungul Diaka also reported the almost unexplained killing of thousands of more people in other incidents. So again, as Dave put it, this is not a man who is going to really balk, quail, weep, and wail at the sight of a little blood or the sight of a few of his people dead, according to all sources. And again, this is a man who owes his position and his position not only on top of the government, but his position is reputedly one of the three or four wealthiest men in the world to his establishment in power by the CIA. Again, the case is true also with the Duvaliers, who had never remained in power without the backing of Western governments, and specifically the United States. And certainly Eric Gary of Grenada owed his short-termed possession of the top office in Grenada almost directly and completely to the CIA. So, again, just making the point that since we do seem to have this connection between Africa and the Caribbean, we also seem to have this connection. These are not these wild and extensively exaggerated outbreaks do not seem to be occurring in countries, say, like Kenya or places like that, where the or Zimbabwe, where the leaders of the government are not beholden unto the United States. And interestingly enough, Africa is not nearly so tribal as it was 100 years ago. There's a great deal of migration from place to place in Africa, and one at least has to wonder if it is one, the result of a place like Zaire being specifically the source of the disease, whether artificially or organically, or two, some kind of an ethnic or cultural predisposition in that area to the disease, because they certainly are seem to be disparate, wildly different rates of the disease throughout these different African countries, based on the reporting we've had so far.
And again, the most important point to be remembered about all of the things that we've been looking at in connection with AIDS in the Third World is the fact that the countries where AIDS is most prevalent in the Third World are nations that are basically U.S.-supported dictatorships and have close connections with the U.S. national security establishment. I'm going to read one more article, and then we're going to take a musical break here. Now, remembering about Zaire, Haiti, Grenada, and the unusually high incidence of AIDS in that in those countries, I'm going to talk about the fact here, or actually discover. Actually, I'm going to read and prove, document the fact that the Central Intelligence Agency, for many years, at least through the mid-70s, maintained a stockpile of biological warfare reagents at Fort Detrick. Now, Fort Detrick, of course, the top Army Chem and Biowarfare Research Center. It evolves into the National Cancer Institute, which discovers, quote-unquote, the AIDS virus, although it continues to share Fort Detrick with the military and continues to work on recombinant DNA in connection with the military. And again, a disease to confound the human immune system, long sought after by our national security establishment. Reading from a book called, reading from a book now called Documents, edited by Christy Macy, M-A-C-Y, and Susan Kaplan. It's basically a series of documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and edited and put together by these two women. Macy and Kaplan's Documents is published in softcover by Penguin Books and copyrighted in 1980. And in here, and under the categorization of document 80A, there's a 1969 CIA memorandum talking about the CIA's stockpile of biological warfare agents at Fort Detrick, and of course eventually again becomes the National Cancer Institute. Reading from documents. Memorandum for Director of Central Intelligence, subject, Contingency Plan for Stockpile of Biological Warfare Agents. 1. On the 25th of November, 1969, President Nixon ordered the Department of Defense to recommend plans for the disposal of existing stocks of bacteriological weapons. On February 14, 1970, he included all toxin weapons. On January 13, 1970, the Special Operations Division at Fort Detrick, Maryland, prepared a requested agent inventory, less toxins, and submitted it to the scientific director, Fort Detrick. This inventory was a required input to assist the commanding officer, Fort Detrick, to prepare a comprehensive plan for demilitarization on site of all biological agents and munitions which are stockpiled in support of operational plans. Under an established agreement with the Department of the Army, the CIA has a limited quantity of biological agents and toxins stored and maintained by the Special Operations Division at Fort Detrick. This stockpile did not appear on the inventory lists. The agents and toxins are, and then there's a series of the species names for the various bacteria that are stored at Fort Detrick. I'm not going to read those to you, but there's about a total of 16 different bacteria here are listed. Continuing. This stockpile capability, plus some research effort and delivery systems, is funded at $75,000 per annum. In the event the decision is made by the Department of Defense to dispose of existing stocks of bacteriological weapons, it is possible that the CIA's stockpile, even though in R&D quantities and unlisted, will be destroyed. 5. If the director wishes to continue this special capability, it is recommended that if the above DOD decision is made, the existing agency stockpile at Special Operations Division Fort Detrick be transferred to the Huntington Research Center, Becton, Dickinson Company, Baltimore, Maryland. Arrangements have been made for this contingency, and assurances have been given by the potential contractor to store and maintain the agency's stockpile at a cost of no greater than $75,000 per year. And that's signed Thomas N. Caramassini's Deputy Director for Plans of the CIA. So, again, up through the late 60s and early 70s, the CIA's Special Operations Division maintained their biological warfare reagents at the very same Fort Detrick, which was to evolve into the National Cancer Institute.
Not to mention the fact that the substance of this article is that the CIA is planning, in direct contravention of a Department of Defense order to, first of all, not list the presence of these toxins, and second of all, to take them and hide them while Fort Detrick is decommissioned. And of course, that leaves open the question of whether they were going to bring them back again when Fort Detrick was recommissioned in its new position, occupying its new area of responsibility in the pursuit of a biological warfare medical defense, as they put it. So again, just an outright and overt attempt by the CIA to hide its biological warfare capacity, even from other elements of the government. Okay, we are going to take a break for a few more minutes here, and then we are going to come back and finish up our archive broadcast on AIDS. And we have had a whole bunch of different stuff that we have covered tonight so far, and we have gone all the way. I don't even think we're going to bother to recap at this moment. We're going to go ahead and then we'll recap at the end of the broadcast when we know how much time that we've got. Okay, the last thing that we were talking about, however, just before the break, Dave read an article about the CIA's manipulation of the lists on what toxins they had, and the fact that it proved that the toxins and the bacteriological warfare stuff was kept at Fort Detrick, and the fact that the CIA, even at the time of the supposed decommissioning of the biological warfare section, was going to just take the stuff and hide it. And of course, our earlier connections between Fort Detrick and the Japanese Project 731 biological warfare tests, we talked about extensively about the use of human guinea pigs and that carryover of that tradition of human guinea pigs into American biological warfare testing and ethno-specific bacteriological agents, namely agents that can be designed to single out a particular group and will only affect, kill, maim, decommission that group. The use of genetic splicing and the suggestion on the part of the Department of Defense's bacteriological and chemical warfare decision that gene splicing could be used to create a disease that would break down the immune system and that would be a disease unknown and unseen before on the face of the earth. And this was in 1969, and Dr. MacArthur of the Chemical Warfare Division of the DOD was postulating a 5 to 10 year time limit. And we saw that 1975 apparently was the period of articulation, as one doctor put it, at which point the disease appeared to change in scope in the Caribbean and in Africa and become something other than what it had been before and become the epidemic-producing organism that we have today. We also, of course, talked at great length about the relative cheapness of life in places like Grenada and Zaire and Haiti, three of the main sources or three of the main vector points of the disease at this point, not, of course, in any real terms, the cheapness of life, but in the cheapness of life in terms of the rulers of those countries, and presumably by extension the cheapness of life in the minds of the people who put those rulers in power, namely in the case of all three of those countries, America's own intelligence establishment, the same CIA that was busy squirreling away anthrax, botulism, and tularemia, disease-producing organisms. Okay, the first article that we're reading coming back from the break here is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, November 22nd, 1985.
Remember the CIA Mobutu connection here.
That's right. Mobutu Sese Seko, the president of Zaire and one of the richest men in the world. Zaire, of course, apparently the main center of AIDS infection in Africa. San Francisco Chronicle, Friday, November 22nd, 1985. Headline, AIDS in Africa meeting stymied. Zaire won't talk. The article is by Randy Schiltz. He's a Chronicle correspondent. Dateline Brussels. The first international symposium on the spread of AIDS in Africa is running into problems even before it opens. The African nation hardest hit by the deadly worldwide epidemic has ordered its scientists not to disclose their findings at the conference. The festering geopolitical problems surrounding AIDS research threaten the success of the conference and dominated much of the talk yesterday when 700 scientific researchers gathered under the auspices of the World Health Organization. The government of Zaire, the Central African nation believed to be hardest hit by AIDS, has instructed its scientists to cancel their planned presentations when the two-day conference convenes this morning at the Palais des Congres. The neighboring state of Burundi has issued similar orders. Throughout Central and Eastern Africa, newspapers and government spokesmen have been heaping scorn on European and American scientists who describe the African continent as the source of the incurable acquired immune deficiency syndrome. On Saturday, Simon Shetemi, the Kenyan Secretary of Health, chastised American scientists for saying AIDS is, quote, rampant in Africa. Quote, "There is an element of racism in all this," Shetemi said. "If the source of AIDS was Africa, and one-tenth of the population is infected, why are Africans not dying in large numbers, such as being reported elsewhere?" The Kenyan official raised some of the very mysteries that AIDS investigators plan to explore in Brussels. They want to know why some areas of Eastern Africa, such as remote regions of Kenya, are heavily populated by people with the AIDS antibodies but no traces of the deadly disease. Scientists wonder if they have acquired some capacity to resist AIDS. Skipping down. Quote, "The Africans are concerned about being the origin of AIDS and are concerned that there might be racist representations made because of it," said Dr. Peter Pyott, who coordinates Zairean AIDS research for the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp. Quote, "It is political, but it isn't the same as in the gay community. But isn't it the same as in the gay community in the beginning? They were afraid that it would be seen as a gay disease and that there would be anti-gay prejudice because of it. Here the concern is similar, that it will be used against the Africans, even the ones who live in Europe," Pyott said. Well, needless to say, of course, AIDS has been popularly seen in the United States as being primarily a, quote, gay disease, and we will talk about that during the course of the last part of the broadcast, and specifically in the last article tonight, what kind of flack the gay community has taken because of AIDS. Again, the interesting point here, there are valid points to be made about the wish on the part of Africans to resist racial stereotyping, but again, the fact that they will allow no research to go on whatsoever, and the fact that Zaire appears to have taken the forefront is certainly interesting. Skipping down to the very end of the article, it says, "An area of paramount concern for Africans and European public health officials is that AIDS in Africa appears to be spread heterosexually in most cases. Such transmission between men and women is extremely rare in the United States, accounting for just 1% of AIDS cases." And of course, also, as we mentioned before, AIDS is not predominantly the fatal disease that it is here in the United States. Again, the main question, and question that people like Dr. Wilbert Jordan, who we're going to be playing the tape of, are looking into is why these changes in the disease, why the disparity in geographical sources, why the disparity in the effect that the disease has, a variety of questions of this sort.
Also, very significantly, the retroactive discovery of AIDS. AIDS was discovered in the United States and then eventually was traced back to these other countries. One of the things that Dr. Wilbert Jordan, by the way, an epidemiologist with Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles, one of the things he's going to point out on a tape we're going to play is that basically no other disease has ever followed this pattern, that retroactive discovery of a disease is unprecedented and highly improbable.
So again, at this point, and as we're getting kind of towards the close of our broadcast tonight, Dave and I both freely admit that neither of us being medical people, and since even the medical people are stumped by the exact cause and origins of the disease at this point, we do not pretend to have the full answer on these things. But these are the kind of questions that, when put in the perspective of the proximity of America's and Britain's also biological warfare apparatus, to AIDS and to the sources of AIDS, as we talked about with Caribbean and African testing and things of that nature, and the apparent willingness in the past on behalf of these groups to test on human guinea pigs, and their direct connection to even more proven insidious testing of human on human beings, in this case prisoners of war, by the Japanese biological warfare scientists, putting these things in the proximity of the already strange nature of AIDS, its spread, its original source, its actual cause, certainly begins to open the question up and begins to make the biological warfare tool argument as advanced, a much more interesting one, and in fact a much more compelling one. And that's what we're basically trying to put together tonight.
Now, the tape you're about to hear is a talk given by Dr. Wilbert Jordan of Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles. He gave this on sister station KPFA in Berkeley on December 16th, 1984. He's being interviewed here by Raina Cowan, a KPFA staff member, and we received permission to play this tape from KPFA General Manager David Salmaker.
One of the growing crises in the United States today is AIDS. And with me on the phone right now, I have a person who's an expert in many different aspects of AIDS. He's the director of graduate medical education at Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles. And he's the ex-public health chief for the southern area of L.A. County. He's had training in infectious diseases, and I want to welcome Dr. Wilbert Jordan to the airways. Good afternoon, doctor.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I had heard about you originally from a friend of mine who was in UCLA Medical School who studied with you, and you had done a lot of research on infectious diseases. And right now, with more and more information coming out about infectious diseases, where they come from, how they start, and I'm especially interested in AIDS, I thought I wanted to get the information of somebody who's an expert in epidemiology. Why don't you begin telling me exactly what epidemiologists study and how this relates to learning about AIDS?
Well, epidemiology really is the study of disease and the disease trends in terms of trying to determine where the disease comes from, how long it takes it to go through a complete cycle, its virulence, how potent it can be, etc. So an epidemiologist really studies the effects, the causes and effects of a disease. He or she doesn't necessarily treat the disease. Some are also medically trained, as I am. Many have masters in public health or doctors in public health and may not be necessarily physicians. But they study disease trends, disease outbreaks, and not treat the individual. So they look at the overall disease in a cluster rather than individual cases.
Well, I can't really say what kind of diseases have you studied, but your expertise, what has it proved about certain diseases, especially in the past few years, diseases like AIDS or the Legionnaire's disease are considered new diseases, like we've never experienced them before.
Right.
What does that actually mean? How can a disease really come out of nowhere?
Well, it isn't that it comes out of nowhere. We have to ask where did it come from. We see swine flu develop. We have the flu vaccine every year, and it changes all the time. Influenza is a changing virus, which is why we give it names like Hong Kong, Brazil, Tokyo, Influenza A Tokyo, because a new strain is found in that area, and we always name it for that. So that's nothing new. We had diseases that are developing all the time. Some of the things that's interesting about AIDS, though, is, to me, is the lack of attention as to where it has come from. We tend to keep looking outside of the United States shores. And I personally, and I'm sure that's my friend, your friend may have told you, have questioned some of the present theories as to where AIDS comes from, just using common sense. And one doesn't have to be an epidemiologist, just look at what we see and ask some questions. This is a disease. It has a high morbidity. It is deadly. It is the most impressive and most critical crisis we've had in public health in any of our generations, whether you're 70 or whether you're 7. This is worse than polio, and even smallpox, I would dare say, was not as critical as this is right now. But I don't think we're really looking at some of the very simple questions in terms of where did this come from, and that's where I think I have disagreed with some other people.
When you mention where it comes from, I have heard stories that it comes from rabbits from southern Japan. I've heard it comes from monkeys from Haiti. I've heard that it started in Haiti or Zaire. Or there's many theories about where it started.
That's, you know, it's interesting about the American personality when we think of ourselves as being better than everybody else. So whenever something bad happens, we always say, where did it come from? Assuming it couldn't have come from here. I think the Haitian theory was really ridiculous. This is a disease that is basically affecting Americans. Over 85% of all cases in the world still, and we're now in the sixth year of this disease, are in America. It is an American disease. Most of the cases in Europe or outside this country, you can trace back to having had contact with someone in this country. The only atypical ones are the ones in France that one can trace back to Zaire, which has been different. But for the most part, the European cases were traced back to the United States. So you have a disease that is affecting a reasonably large number of people with a very high mortality rate. At this point, those who even live to get out of the hospital the first time have a life expectancy of about 2 years. The overwhelming majority in the United States, three metropolitan areas particularly, New York, San Francisco, and L.A., that's unusual. Viruses, bacteria, don't do that. Diseases don't create themselves, or don't become born in one country, get on a plane or a boat, go to a second country, become epidemic for 2 or 3 years, and then be found retrospectively in the first country. And I said it because this is what was said about Haiti. The first 500 cases that we knew about were in this country. There were no cases in Haiti. And those persons who had it hadn't been to Haiti, hadn't been around any Haitians. San Francisco is epidemic right now. You don't have many Haitians there. And in fact, I think if you have any cases, then it's been more than one or two in persons who are Haitian. So it's not like you have cases. In fact, in American cities that have large number of Haitians, i.e. Washington, D.C., Boston, Philadelphia, you don't have many cases of AIDS. Miami is a port that has them, and so does New York. But your other major cities that have large Haitian populations don't have large cases of AIDS.
So where do you think AIDS does come from?
I think we have to look at our own 48 states and ask where does it come from. And I say that because if you look at Haiti again, and you can say, well, let's look at Haiti. If we accept that theory, that means either someone from here went there and got it and brought it back, or someone from there brought it to this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you said someone from here went there, the first case were in white homosexual male majority, then I would have to ask, one, why only white homosexual males from New York, San Francisco, and L.A.? Frankly, those white homosexual males who travel to Haiti for a adventurous trip don't tend to get involved with a dirty-looking native boy, to sound very whatever, but tend to meet other people coming also from other country. Secondly, a large number of white homo and heterosexuals from Europe also go to Haiti. So if it was from someone going to Haiti from this country, then one, why the predominance in those three cities? And two, why didn't we see it also in Europe, since you have whites from Europe also going to Haiti?